Join me, Kevin Kelly, host of Morning Classical Music on WYLL and music director of the Prairie Ensemble for the WYLL-FM Concert in the Park. The Prairie Ensemble will perform music by Walton, Mozart, and Mendelssohn. The concert begins at 5 with Celtic music by the Academy of Irish Music. Bring a picnic or buy food from our grill. Join us Saturday at Allerton Park. WYLL-FM's Concert in the Park is underwritten by the Illinois Arts Council, a state agency, and Kent and Lisa Shirley of Twin City Honda BMW. You're listening to WYLL Urbana.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Little Theater on the Square in Sullivan, presenting Hello Dolly from Wednesday, June 9th through Sunday, June 27th. America's Most Beloved Matchmaker is played by Illinois native Anna McNeely, who has appeared on Broadway in Little Johnny Jones, Beauty and the Beast, Cats, and Gypsy. Ticket information is available at 1-888-261-9675.
Good morning and welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Travis Stansel, and Henry Frayne, is at the controls this morning. Well, I think probably if you went out and you started asking people about their complaints about life, the things that they did not like about their life, I'm sure a lot of people would tell you the same thing. They would say that, you know, there just isn't enough time to get done what we want to do. It seems that every day the world around us moves faster and faster, and we are struggling to cram more and more activities into every minute of every hour of every day. At the same time, there are people all around the world in different ways making a very deliberate effort to slow down. There are people who want to have a better balance between their work life and their home life and make more time for their families. They want to spend time enjoying their meals with their family and their friends. They want to be able to do things like walk and meditate and make love in an unhurried sort of way. This morning on Focus 580, we'll be talking with a journalist. His name is Carl Honoré. He's Canadian. He's based in London, and who has looked at this phenomenon, this what seems to be a worldwide phenomenon, and has written a book about it. And his book is titled In Praise of Slowness. The subtitle is How a Worldwide Movement is Challenging the Cult of Speed. The book is published by Harper San Francisco. It is out now if you'd like to take a look at it. Our guest has written for a number of different publications. He's written for The Economist, for The Houston Chronicle, The Miami Herald, and The National Post of Canada, and is joining us this morning by telephone as we talk. Our questions, comments are certainly welcome. This is one where people can certainly call and tell us about their own experiences with the pace of life and maybe what they're doing or have tried to do to slow down. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that's 800-222-9455. At any point here, people want to join the conversation, they can do that. Mr. Honoré, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for having me on the show.
We certainly appreciate it. Well, tell us about how it is you started thinking about this. You have some personal experience here that started you thinking about maybe it would be a good idea for you personally to try to slow down a bit.
Yes. Well, I think when anyone gets into that whipped up state where everything is a race against the clock and every moment of the day is a dash to a finish line and you're always hectic and you're always hurried, you get a wake-up call. And for a lot of people, that's a health thing. You may be talking about an ulcer or a heart attack or a breakdown. Or for others, a relationship unravels because you haven't had the time or the tranquility to talk or listen to the other person. But for me, it all started when I began reading bedtime stories to my son, who at the time was 2.5 years old. And anyone who knows anything about children knows that they don't take kindly to being hurried, particularly at bedtime. But 3 years ago, which is when all this started for me, that didn't mean a whole lot because I was a speedaholic. I was Mr. Hurry. So there I was, you know, at the end of the day, zooming through The Cat in the Hat, skipping a line here, a paragraph there, and sometimes, I'm ashamed to say, a whole page. And of course, my son, like all his peers, knew the text inside out. So he'd be berating me for reading too fast or for skipping the bit about thing one and thing two. And what should have been really the most precious, the most intimate, the most relaxed, the most tender moment of the day, instead was a gladiatorial battle of wills between his desire to go slowly and my desire to go quickly. And it all came to a head for me when I was in an airport and I picked up a newspaper which had an article of full of time-saving tips for busy people. And it included a section on a series of books called the One-Minute Bedtime Story. And I kind of feel a cold shiver go down my spine now when I say those words, but of course my first reaction then was, hallelujah, this is exactly what I need to speed up the bedtime ritual even more. But then, you know, thankfully, and I think to my credit, my next thought was, whoa, you know, has it really come to that? Am I really in such a hurry all the time that I'm even now prepared to fob off my son with a soundbite at the end of the day? And that's kind of when a light bulb went on over my head, and I took a step back and began looking at how my whole life had become just an endless dash to keep up or to get ahead. And I started looking at how everybody else seemed to be caught up in the same kind of maelstrom of hurry and impatience, and that's sort of where it all began.
Yeah, and it's certainly not just you. I think that many people feel that way. I'm sure a lot of people listening to us would say, yes, I understand that. In the book here, you quote a man, an American physician named Larry Dossey, who now more than 20 years ago coined a term, time sickness, to describe this idea that we are obsessed with, that there isn't enough time. Time's getting away. We have to go really fast to get done everything that we have to do. Why do you think that is? What has happened? Because certainly if you look at the pace of life and look at the way people lived their lives in previous generations, I think that probably most people would not, they wouldn't know how to relate to this. They just didn't experience life that way. So obviously something, probably many things have changed. What do you think it is?
Yes, many things have changed. And when you look at the way the world has accelerated, you have to turn to the usual suspects. So you look at how technology has sped us up and made it possible to do things around the clock, or the workplace where deadlines get tighter and tighter. But I think when you cut through a lot of the sort of historical or cultural trends, you get to what may be the nub of the question, which is how we think about time itself. And in the West, we have this very fixed idea that time is finite. You know, time is money, as Benjamin Franklin said. And it's a phrase that trips off our tongue all the time nowadays. You know, we greet a friend in the street, and we don't have time for a chat. We zip off and say, time is money, over our shoulder. And, of course, time is valuable. It may be the greatest gift we have. But what we do with the idea that time is money is we think, well, how do I get value for money? And what we do is we speed up. You know, we try and do more and more with less and less time. And I think that's a lot of what lies at the heart of this kind of chronic sense of time poverty now, is that we are just simply trying to do far too much. I mean, there's as many hours in the day as there were 200 years ago, but we're trying to do, you know, 10 million times more things than the average person in the, you know, 19th century.
And that does maybe get to the question of ultimately is responsible, and whether this is something that has been forced on us, and that it's something that we have to, that external circumstance has put on us, or we have taken this on. And of course, if that's the case, then we're the ones that are going to have to say, well, we're just not going to do that anymore. We're going to try to do something different.
But, well, I suspect that it's a bit of both. I mean, we have an economic system that is predicated on people spending, consuming more and more, and you know, going deeper and deeper into debt to do more and more, buy more and more, and consume more and more. So that's a kind of systemic pressure on us to keep in the fast lane, to keep in high gear, to keep going, doing, achieving. But there's also our own approach. I mean, I think it's exciting to go fast. It's exciting to do lots of things. You get an adrenaline rush. I mean, speed is fun. It's sexy, and it's easy to fall into its spell and to become a kind of worshiper of speed. I mean, the important thing I think to underline about this whole worldwide movement against the cult of speed and doing everything faster and constantly being hectic is that it's not about slowing everything down to a crawl. I mean, speed is good in its place. The problem is that we've kind of taken that speed is good idea and applied it right across our lives so that we're kind of stuck in fast-forward mode. You know, you may have to move quickly. In fact, you almost certainly have to move quickly at the office, say, or in the factory to meet a deadline. But when we leave the workplace, we carry on going fast. So we're, you know, you're driving at 50 miles an hour through a school zone, or you're gobbling down your dinner as though you're on a deadline even though you're not, or, as in my case, you know, your speed reading bedtime stories. So it's kind of, it becomes a mindset. You get marinated in this whole speedy approach, and that is something you can start changing on a personal level.
Do you think that this affects us in more than ways that are spiritual or psychological, or maybe even going further than just people's complaints? And I'm certainly one of those who says, well, I'm just tired all the time. Do you think that it really affects us in ways that are physical and that it has significant effects on our health?
I think that there's little doubt of that. I mean, the human body works well under stress and going fast some of the time, but if you forget how to switch off, it starts to take a toll on the the nervous system, on the heart, the cardiac system. I mean, you look at the rising incidence of burnout, people burning out younger and younger, even children now turning up in doctor surgeries with stress-related illnesses. People not sleeping enough. I mean, on average, we're now sleeping about 90 minutes less than we did a century ago, and that's got to make people tired. So I think there's no question that we're kind of collectively burning ourselves out physically. But you mentioned the word spiritual and psychological. That's a very important aspect of the damage that this hurry-up, always-on speed culture inflicts on us, because when you're in a rush, you haven't got the calmness or the time to engage with other people or even with yourself. And in some ways, the whole speedaholic approach to life, the whole roadrunner way of living, is a form of denial, I think, for many people. Because when you're going fast, you don't look inside yourself and ask the big questions about, am I happy? Am I healthy? Are my relationships good? Am I making the most of my life? You just go. You're just going fast. You're just going to keep up. And very tellingly, therapists have noticed that one of the final stages, if not the final stage, before a proper full-blown burnout is one last burst of acceleration, almost as though the person is trying to outrun the problems and questions festering below the surface with one last sprint, into the distance. But, of course, you just end up in oblivion that way.
Our guest in this hour of Focus, Carl Honoré, is a Canadian journalist. He's based in London, and his book is titled In Praise of Slowness, How a Worldwide Movement is Challenging the Cult of Speed, published by Harper San Francisco. Questions welcome, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. We have a caller here on a cell phone, line number one, to bring in the conversation. Hello.
Yeah, I actually think that time is money is really backwards, and that money is actually time, and that we've reified the notion of money as something valuable in and of itself, as opposed to it being a medium of exchange for my labor and or goods or expertise, for someone else's labor and or goods or expertise. And I think that's one of the reasons why people are so often get as crazy as they do, is that they think there's something real about money. And don't get me wrong, I mean, I like having money, and I'm not saying that that's not important to some extent, but money isn't real. It's really a way to exchange time for someone else's time. Mm-hmm. So I'd be interested in hearing your comment on that.
I think that that's in a way just rotating the equation and looking at it from a different angle. I mean, if on one hand you say that we're too obsessed with money and materialism, I think that's probably true. But I think the fact that we use that form of words, that time is money, and money seems to be the most important thing in our society, I think that underlines how important time is to us. And the fact that we're misusing time by speeding through it in every moment is where we need to start reassessing, it seems to me.
Okay.
All right. Well, thanks for the comment. Other folks who are listening, you have thoughts, questions, comments, you want to be a part of the conversation, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. I'm wondering to what extent you really think that we do have that it's fair to talk about what different people are doing in different places to try to slow the pace of their life and to be more deliberate about things like dining and sex and being with their families. To what extent that this does actually constitute a movement, or is that going a little far? And when talking about a worldwide movement challenging the cult of speed?
No, I think very much there is a movement, and even people who are making these slowing down or committing these acts of deceleration, more and more of them right across the Western world are using the phrase the slow movement, and it's intriguing because that English word slow has moved beyond the English speaking countries and has spread out into all across Europe, Italy obviously, which has the slow food movement, into Japan, and everywhere you find people using the English word slow as shorthand for this better, more sensible, more balanced way of living, sometimes going fast, sometimes going slowly, but always trying to choose the right speed so that you're getting the most out of what you do. And this kind of idea of slow with a capital S has become a real lightning rod for people right across, the industrial world, I guess, to include Japan. So you find, for instance, an American professor of education in the University of Colorado recently published a manifesto for slow schooling, which was taking a slower approach to education. And a group in Norway has recently set up, calling itself Slow Future. And my book, which has been published or is being published in countries around the world, in Germany, the title is actually an English title. It's Slow Life. So I think that certainly from a brand recognition point of view, the slow movement really has, acquired a kind of critical mass. But if you look at what really is a movement, some people might say, well, the slow movement doesn't have a central website or a headquarters or even one figurehead or president or movement. But to that, I would say, well, what social movement of any consequence in history has ever had those things? I suspect that having them would atrophy a movement. It would cause it to become ingrown. Any social movement that's going to make real change has to start at the grassroots. It has to have individuals making changes, groups working together, sometimes disagreeing over the means, but always striving towards the same final goal. So if you look at, pick any movement over the last 40 years, say feminism, which started, let's say, 40 years ago. In the early years when women began challenging the status quo, perhaps starting to work or overturn the unfair relationship in the home, many of them in those days, the early days, didn't think they were even part of a movement, and the word feminist didn't come on the scene until much later. And yet, I think now, looking back, no one would argue that there's no such thing as a feminist movement. Ditto the environmentalist movement or even the civil rights movement, I think.
Hmm. Well, let's talk with someone else here. We have another caller here who is also on cell phone, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. I was just hearing your show and thinking. I'm a therapist by trade, and I noticed that there is a culture of fast movement and do this fast, do that fast. But also, I think that one of the barriers to people being able to go slow is that they may be fearful of what they're going to hear internally, inside themselves, when they slow down. That busyness is a way to distract themselves from getting comfortable with solitude, from getting comfortable with knowing themselves. And so I think one of the beauties of being in therapy is learning how to go slow and learning how to know yourself. And people, after they get to that point, really do begin enjoying life more. They begin savoring the moments that they have both by themselves and with others. This isn't a commercial for therapy by any means, but I guess I just wanted to bring up that it's not all cultural. Some of it is internal, that people are really afraid to slow down and just hear the quiet inside themselves sometimes. I wondered if you could speak to that.
Well, that's absolutely true, and I think I made the point earlier when I said that speed is a form of denial. It's a way of running away from the questions inside. I think collectively we seem to have lost the art of being quiet, of relaxing in solitude, of looking inside. And yes, for many people it's daunting, because once you've got yourself wound up into a kind of turbocharged state, and things are maybe not going right, and you're not particularly enjoying your life, it's scary to think about putting on the brakes and looking inside. But as you say, and I've spent 3 years going around the world interviewing people who have taken that jump. You know, they have pushed through that barrier of unease or fear or even embarrassment sometimes.
Right.
And come out the other side. And you're absolutely right that when people do relearn that forgotten skill, that forgotten art of being slow, that everything falls, I mean, most things, and in many cases, everything falls into place. They just find that, and I find this in my own life, that everything seems to have a more vivid color. I feel like I'm enjoying my life rather than rushing through it. And I think that's absolutely right what you've said. I mean, whether it's therapy, which is a slowing down in a formal setting, or if it's just slowing down in your own life by unplugging and allowing yourself just to shift down into a very low gear. Perhaps meditation, perhaps just sitting quietly in a room can be a starting point for people.
And I think people get it. Excuse me. I think they get a taste of that when they go on vacation, but then they come back into their world, and with almost without thinking, they speed right back up to the speed they were before, and so that brief taste of what it was like to live more slowly is lost.
Exactly, and of course nowadays when people's vacations are shorter and shorter, they almost get a smaller and smaller taste and don't have the time really to sink right into that kind of warm bath of slowness. I mean, so many vacations now are just 2 or 3 days, aren't they? And for many of us it takes a couple of days just to wind down from the wound-up state we exist in the working.
The only other thing I was going to say, if I may just jump in and then I'm going to get off for another caller, but the other thing that I was going to say is that people in general, when you meet someone who has reached this point where they have slowed down, they are in tune with themselves and they are enjoying each and every moment of life, it's almost like they are operating on a whole different frequency and they're quite enjoyable to be with. And I can't help but think that a whole lot of very positive social changes would come about if people did their own interior work. They would have the energy and the vision to do great things in the world. Maybe that's overly optimistic, but I really think it could start there.
I don't think that's overly optimistic, actually, because I think the big changes start often with small changes, and that's so
right.
True that when people have a kind of inner, you know, harmony, if they've found that peace, and what you often find is that they end up engaging so much more with people around them. I mean, their children, their partners, you know, they start to talk to their neighbors, they get involved with their communities. I mean, all of these things that we think of as being either lost or being lost, something as simple and as wonderful as community can be rebuilt when people learn to slow down individually, because part of that is plugging back into a bigger picture.
Right. Okay, I'm going to hang up and someone else can call. Thank you very
okay,
much.
Okay, well, thank you. Let's go on. We'll hear next talk with someone on line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I think it's an interesting conversation. In my own life, I left a job teaching in the public schools and became a full-time mom and have enjoyed it. I know there are lots of people who sort of question the validity of doing that kind of thing because it's very old-fashioned, but I find, I have found for many years that it's very interesting. There's more than enough to keep me going and doing all kinds of things, interesting things, I think. And it has a sort of a spin-off effect in terms of, for example, that influencing the kinds of food we eat, which is to say that I prepare food at home and so forth in 99% of the cases, as opposed to eating out a lot or bringing food in. But the real reason I called is that several weeks ago I bought a book on the remainder table called Faster. I don't know if you've probably heard about it.
Yes, I've read it.
And I found that I had to give it up. I quit after about 30 or 40 pages because it was making me sort of keyed up and neurotic or whatever just to read about what I think is like the excessive pace of a lot of things and sort of going back and looking at and quantifying different ways in which time was measured and accelerated and so forth and so on. And I sort of played this game with myself, and I thought, well, you know, I can read this a little bit at a time, and I can get through it and so forth and so on. And I finally decided it basically wasn't good for me to read about the acceleration of the pace of life. So I just put it aside and said, you know, somebody else can read that and so forth, but it's just not for me.
I read that book myself as part of my research, sort of at the beginning of my journey away from speedaholism. And even though I was very fast at the time, I found it made me feel even more breathless just reading about the many and horrifying examples of ways in which we are constantly and obsessively looking for little tricks to save a second here or a minute there. And there's, I mean, the one, for instance, I don't know if you remember it or got that far in the book, I think he says that on many elevators, the door close button, you know, the one that you see people frantically pushing, so often it's not even connected to the elevator. It's just literally there to give you, to help you dissipate your impatience, you know. And it's just, everywhere I find I look around, there are absurd examples of this hurry-up approach to things. Just when I live in London, England, and just before I left, it was a huge poster campaign with posters up on all the bus shelters in the city, and it was for a new product, and it was called Yoga in a Bottle. And you think, people can't even take the time to slow down with yoga. They've got to have it in an instant format. Then, you know, goodness me.
That's ridiculous. Thank you for the conversation.
Well,
have a good afternoon.
Well, thank you. And certainly other people who are listening are welcome to participate. If you'd like to call in and talk with our guest, Carl Honoré, you can do that. 333-9455 is the Champaign Urbana number, and toll-free is 800-222-9455. Carl Honoré is a Canadian journalist. He's based in London. He's written for The Economist, The Houston Chronicle, Miami Herald, and The National Post of Canada. And the book, by the way, is titled In Praise of Slowness, How a Worldwide Movement is Challenging the Cult of Speed. Harper San Francisco is the publisher. Maybe just to talk about, one other thing that maybe before we go too farther, I guess I would want to ask you about. I understand that you are in Chicago to take part in some organizational meetings for an organization called Take Back Your Time. And I think that this was inspired by a book of the same name.
Yes, that's right. It's a kind of movement for people, as the title says, to take back their time. So it's a backlash against the culture, particularly acute in the United States, of working insanely long hours. So it's about getting that balance between work and life. So there's a three-day conference here in Chicago at Loyola University, which is bringing together all kinds of different people, mainly from North America, but some from overseas, who are looking at ways that people can reclaim their time, because in a way all of this boils down to our relationship with time, and it's so harried and so neurotic that we need to make it healthier. We need to lighten it so that we get through time in a more, you know, calm and a more balanced, a more rich manner. So part of that may be for people working fewer hours, but for others it may just be sort of slowing down outside the workplace. The fact that all these people have come together, it's the first national conference for this particular movement and group, is a real pointer to the fact that things are going on just below the radar, even here in the United States.
Mm-hmm. You talk about a number of different kinds of movements that are essentially interested in slowing down the pace of things in different ways, and one of them, and one that probably people will have heard of, as I know people that are here in this community that are interested in it, is the slow food movement. And when you think about, what is slow food, you right away you have to say to people, well, you know what fast food is, right?
Yeah.
Well, slow food is the opposite of that. And it's got a fascinating history, because it all started by an Italian who was very unhappy about McDonald's coming to town. And McDonald's set up a restaurant there, and they were selling fries and Big Macs. And apparently he wanted to remind Italians just how good their own food was. And so he set up a little table there right in front of McDonald's and started making pasta and things just to say, hey, folks, you know, yeah, you can go in and have the Big Mac, but look at this. Look at this good thing. And from there, it spread all over the place, and it's really been embraced by people who like to cook, who like good food, and who really like the idea that a mealtime should be a shouldn't be rushed, and it should be an opportunity to have to enjoy the company of your family and your friends and really have a good time, rather than be something like, what can we make that's really fast, and we got to get this done because we got to go and run off and do these other things, so you know we have to eat in 10 minutes and then get on with the rest of the life.
Yeah.
This is the complete opposite that says, no, wait a minute. Time out here. This is, you know, and if one good place to start thinking about that is mealtime.
It's at the table. That's right. I mean, the way we eat is one of the main areas where the speed culture takes the most heavy toll. I mean, you need only think of how unpleasant eating fast food can be when compared to just cooking a simple meal and eating it around the table with friends. I mean, I've just been in Chicago now for a couple of days. And I've seen at least a dozen people driving and eating at the same time with a fork and a dish or something or other, or a burger. And sometimes you may have to eat on the run, but I think that we're really shortchanging ourselves in the sense that food can be the source of so much pleasure. And we all know this because we've all, even in our busy, hectic lives, we've all had a wonderful meal at some point, beautifully presented, beautifully cooked, and enjoyed at a leisurely pace. And so we can get some of that into our daily lives. It doesn't have to mean that every meal will be a five-course banquet made from, you know, local produce. But it's about kind of honoring food and giving it a little bit more time so that you can actually get real pleasure out of it. And the fact that slow food, which did start in Italy, has now spread right across the planet and has, I think, 80,000 members now in 50 countries, including 8,000 here in the U.S., the U.S. generally being seen as the home of fast food, I think, is a very good sign. And there, wherever you look, actually, there are examples of people waking up to the fact that they're just missing out by hurrying through the whole eating experience. I part of my book tour took me through Canada, and they're just about to launch a new reality TV series up there, which is going to teach families the lost art of going to a supermarket, buying some fresh ingredients, coming home, cooking them, and then eating them around the table with the family or friends instead of guzzling it on your lap in front of the TV. And you think, well, how come people need to be taught that? But of course they do, because those simple skills have been lost in the space of a generation in many families. And this program has found itself inundated by families desperate to get on because they so much want to get back to that simpler, slower approach to food. And the show is going to be called aptly Fixing Dinner.
Uh-huh. Let's talk with someone else. We have another caller here on the campus, line number one. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. It's a great show. I wanted to raise the question of class and even race or, for example, working in poor people are very often called failures because they appear to be, you know, just lounging around and socializing and they're not working, they're not doing enough to get out of their particular impoverishment. But I'm wondering if your book includes an examination of the difference between middle and upper class people in relation to how they use time compared to working and poorer people who in the States or wherever use time.
I don't go into that in great depth, partly because I'm covering so much ground in so many different countries. I mean, I do touch on the differences, you know, between poor and rich, but I think it's important to stress that we're all caught up in the same cult or culture of hurry and speed, or most of us anyway. And it's not just, you know, Wall Street bankers doing 90-hour weeks. You know, I've got a website. The address is inpraiseofslowness.com. And I'm getting emails from all over the world. And I'm getting them from, you know, places like small-town Wyoming, where people are saying to me, you know, I'm speed-reading bedtime stories to my son, you know, and I felt the horror of recognition. So I think this is something that we all are prey to. Now, when you talk about whether people have the luxury to slow down, then that's another matter.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're earning 100 grand a year, it's easier for you to, say, work fewer hours and earn 75 grand than it is if you're on 20,000 a year and trying to support, you're a single mom and you're trying to support three kids. But the fact is that, I mean, there's an organization in the United States called the Center for the New American Dream. And their thrust is all about helping people get that balance between work and life and consuming a bit less. And they've got many people on the books who are earning less than 20,000 a year who are finding ways to cut back a little bit on consumption, and maybe, you know, instead of juggling three jobs, maybe two and a half or two. I mean, it's not an ideal scenario, but they're finding that they have a bit more time and that they, too, can slow down. I was on a radio show in Baltimore, and a woman called up, and she was the kind of archetypal, rushed, single mother, two kids and three jobs and so on. And she found herself at one point calling her daughter at her daughter's birthday party because she couldn't get off work. And that was sort of when she thought, hang on, this has just got way out of hand.
Yeah.
And she started looking. She went home and threw up all her expenditure and her income and so on, and worked out that she was just about to buy a third TV set, you know, that kind of thing. So, I mean, that's not going to be everybody's circumstances, obviously. But, you know, she was able, just by cutting back a little bit, to ditch her third job. And that made a huge difference to the pace of her life and the quality of her life.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. And now we have a number of other people who want to join us. Let's see. We'll go next to line two. I think we have someone here on cell phone. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I was wondering if you could go a little bit more into what has changed in our society. Are you talking about the last 20 years, the last 15, the last 30? You know, is there something in politics and not economics, Reaganomics, the Reagan Revolution, or what? I mean, I don't think it started there, but that people have so much fear and lack of social security, like support systems, or lack of actually, you know, like in Europe, some kind of social net. People don't have insurance, they don't have retirements. It seems like it can't be just individuals deciding, I'm going to change my lifestyle, although there's certainly nothing wrong with that if they can manage it. But it seems like it's there's a lot of pressure. Like someone was talking about, oh, this internal feeling, but where does that internal feeling come from if not from the social structures, the cultural structures, the economic structures around us?
Yes, I mean, the acceleration of the modern world, I would say, began in earnest anyway in the kind of 19th century with industrialization and urbanization, and things got progressively faster and faster. And all along the way, there was always a parallel track of people saying, hang on, things are a little bit too fast, we need to rethink, and so on. And that's kind of carried on all the way through the 20th century until now, the early 21st. But it seems to me that there's been a real, you know, quantum leap forward in terms of speed and the pressure to go fast in the last 20 years. And I suppose I'd probably point the finger at two phenomena there. One is technology, the way the Internet and cell phones and so on have made us available, everything available, round the clock. I mean, that puts a lot of pressure on everybody to be always on and always going. But the second thing is, and you talked about Reaganomics, I mean, I'd sort of look at it in bigger terms as kind of the triumph of the free market and the global economy, which puts enormous pressure on the individual to steam ahead and to go. And that is probably more sharply felt in the U.S. because, as you say, there aren't the same social safety nets as there are in Europe. And that is a problem for, you know, that's something that has to change, I think, if people are going to be able to slow down right across the board. You would need to make changes on the individual level, but you also need to make changes, you know, on the legislative and the collective level. And that's happening more quickly in Europe, where they have been, as you know, across the board or collectively cutting working hours, and they've imposed, the European Union has imposed a 48-hour maximum work week, which, you know, there are exceptions to that and opt-outs, but essentially they've drawn a line in the sand that says, you know, for the most part, we think that 50 hours a week is about enough for people. And if they don't want to work more than that, they now have the legislative tools to stop employers forcing them to do so. So things like that are occurring in other countries. But I even see here changes in the U.S. And it seems to me that in this country, change often starts in the courts, doesn't it, rather than the legislative branch. And what you're starting to see now is individual workers taking the big players, Walmart, you know, Starbucks, to court over questions of overwork or forcing them to do unpaid overtime, and winning those cases. And I think that may be the start of a kind of collective or legislative rethink. I mean, it's not going to happen in the next year, but I think that there's a sign there that the tide may be about to turn. There's certainly a very strong groundswell in favor of it. I mean, everywhere, I've been all across the U.S. touring for the book and talking to people on radio and in bookstores and so on. And I can't think of one really who's come up to me and said, I think the way we're doing things now is exactly right, that we should be working people 80 hours a week. I mean, it's a very difficult thing to defend. I don't think anybody really wants it. It's a question of how we get out of that scenario and what kind of big changes, what kind of structural changes we're prepared to make as a society to allow the change on the individual and collective level to occur.
Yes, it seems like people are just being snookered into this thing about family values, but certainly if people don't have time to eat together or to see one another, then it's not going to be good for the family.
No, this is a strange irony of kind of small-c conservative economic or neocon views, is that they're all peddling family values, but they at the same time are the most staunch supporters of an economic system that forces people to work incredibly long hours. So there's a definite inconsistency there, and I think people feel it. You know, people in the street feel it. They can see it. So, you know, it's a question of, you know, going to, you know, working it through the courts or, you know, lobbying your congressman or your senator. You know, there are mechanisms to bring about change. I mean, you know, the civil rights movement made huge changes in this country over, you know, 30, 40 years. It didn't happen overnight, but, you know, change has occurred. So I think that... I think the kind of slowing down of the slow movement is sort of at the same point in the same trajectory at the beginning, where people have woken up to the folly of the way we live now, and now they're making changes or pushing for change on the individual and the collective front at the same time.
Well, how does this relate to the labor movement, which is more or less seen as demise? I mean, is labor movement at all involved in this notion of you know, people need time to live?
Well, I think it is. It is much more outside the U.S., I think the labor movement in the United States put more emphasis on getting more money for people rather than the idea that winning them more leisure time or more time off. Whereas in Europe, very much the labor movement is about, and not just the labor movement, I mean, governments are talking until they're blue in the face these days now about the need for work-life balance, that people are just being worked too hard. I think there's a dichotomy there. I think in the United States there's more of a bias towards kind of crazy caricature almost of the Protestant work ethic, you know, the kind of keep your nose on that grindstone all day long approach.
And that'll make you a good person.
Yeah, exactly, which of course it doesn't. But, I mean, I wouldn't say, and I don't think most people would say, that work is in and of itself an evil. In fact, work can be a wonderful thing. It can be, you know, empowering and ennobling and great fun and so on. But when it takes over everything, then something's wrong. And that's sort of where we are at the moment, particularly in the U.S., which is now, of course, working longer hours than anybody else in the industrial world, even the Japanese.
I need to jump in here. I hope the caller will forgive me. We only have 10 minutes, actually a little bit less. I have a couple of other callers, and for the benefit of anybody who might have tuned in recently, I think I should also reintroduce our guest, Carl Honoré. He's a Canadian journalist. He's based in London, and if you would like to read more on this idea of the speed of life and people who are making deliberate efforts to slow down, you might look for his book. It's titled In Praise of Slowness. The subtitle is How a Worldwide Movement is Challenging the Cult of Speed, and Harper San Francisco is the publisher. We do have some others, and we'll keep going here, try to get everybody in before we find ourselves out of time. The next caller in line is in Urbana, and line 3. Hello.
Yes, hello?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Thank you for taking my call. I very much agree with much of what the commentator is saying, although I think the cure that he's describing is something that I would personally subscribe to, but I think the disease is, frankly, grossly misdiagnosed, and let me tell you what I mean by that. I just frankly reject this notion that we live in a society today where everybody is harried and doesn't have time enough to do whatever, to cook with their families or go out for walks and that sort of thing. And the reason I say this is because of one very simple statistic that often gets conveniently left out of these arguments, and that's the number of hours that Americans spend in front of the television set.
TV, yeah.
These have varied somewhat over the years, but they seem to be somewhere in the neighborhood of 35 to 40 hours a week, which I find absolutely astonishing. So, in fact, I think the reason is, I think we've sort of talked ourselves into believing that we work harder than we do because of this Protestant work ethic, because if we somehow don't work these 80 hours a week, which I think is a total fabrication, I've never met anybody in my life who works 80 hours a week. I've met a few who claim to, and then when I get to know them, I realize that it's, that, you know, that that's absolutely preposterous. I mean, we can't have people working 80 hours a week if they therefore turn around and work 40 and watch TV for 40 hours. So the fact is, the reason that people say that they don't have time to sit around the table and cook a meal and spend time with their families is not because they're working too hard. It's because they have to run out in front of the television to watch their 2, 3, 4 hours a night of TV. This is not working, sitting in front of a television, and this is not an activity which brings a family together for the most part. And I think there's also a little bit of a conspiracy on the part of the food industry to convince people. I mean, all the commercials that you see on TV are based on convincing people that they work too hard to do anything else but open a can or to open a TV dinner. So anyway, that's the comment that I'd like to make. I'd be especially interested in how you can reconcile the statistics about television viewership with this, what I think is a myth, that we live in this tremendously harried, busy lifestyle. And one other statistic to throw in there, we always talk about families, but the fact is that these days only 30% of American households consist of families with school-aged children. And so, again, I think this is sort of skewing the statistics here. And I'll get off the line and listen. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for the call. Well, I'm sure you would at the very least, I'm sure you would agree with the caller that part of what we're talking about here is looking at how you use your time.
Of course.
And making deliberate kind of decisions about how you want to allocate it and making the best use of the hours that you have.
Exactly. And the caller has put his finger on something very, very important, which is the fact that TV has kind of become the great black hole of time for many of us now, and I think this average statistic per day anywhere in the U.S. now is about 4 hours a day. And when you think that if the average American is watching 4 hours of TV a day and then everybody's moaning about how they don't have enough time, I mean, there may just be a connection between those two facts. I would question, however, the assumption or the assertion that people aren't working long hours and aren't tired out by it. I think one of the reasons that people do slide into that long hours TV mode is that they are stressed, that they are working hard and fast at work, that they don't get lunch breaks anymore, that their coffee breaks are frowned on, that they're multitasking, that they come home and they're still often, you know, in touch with the office or checking in the company database or taking calls. They can't switch off. And that's exhausting. And so it's easy to slump down on the sofa at the end of the day. I mean, I used to do it, too, when I was caught in that kind of fast-forward approach to everything. You know, you sit down at the end of the day. There's maybe one program you want to watch, but, you know, you're still there 3 hours later. I think that it's sometimes difficult for people to break out of that because it just becomes a way of life almost. But it's, in a way, it's not that difficult. It's often just as simple as saying no, I'm not gonna watch 4 hours of TV tonight, and just switching it off and doing something else. I mean, going into the kitchen and cooking that meal, or sitting in the backyard with your partner, or going for a walk around the neighborhood. These things that aren't really that exhausting. In fact, they're all often in the long run a lot more energizing than watching TV, because a lot of research suggests that TV is quite sapping, and that people feel kind of deflated and unhappy and more tired after watching TV, although it's peddled to us as a great, you know, force for relaxation.
Yeah. Well, we have some other calls. We'll try to get in at least one more. And this is Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Are you serious that the elevator close button doesn't do anything at all?
I'm sorry to say that's been reported as a true fact.
that's hilarious. I love that. I'm sure it's perfectly reasonable. You know, when I used to drive across town to work in the morning, I would either, you know, in the kitchen I would cook an egg sandwich or the fast food place, get one there, and I would just gobble down an egg sandwich on the way to work. And I never minded that, because I always figured that, you know, these slow food movements say, well, we should take our time, you know, and kind of enjoy ourselves. I mean, I don't mind taking out a little time away from away from my eating time, but I like to use my time for just kind of thinking about things and kind of planning out, you know, the longer term and thinking about the overall picture and how things are going. And so I guess, I mean, every person has their own priorities.
Right. I mean, I think that's a very, very sound point. It's not a one-size-fits-all recipe. I mean, some people will put more value on food and want to spend more time on that. But, I mean, you're devoting time to thinking about what's going on in your life and the world around you and so on. It's equally valuable, definitely. I mean, some people just aren't particularly interested in food. I mean, you don't want to ram these things down people's throats. So, you know, a sandwich on the go is absolutely fine.
Yeah, so, and anyway, I wanted to say that, you know, the first step, that they say, you know, the first step is to realize that you have a problem. And I don't think the being hurried at work is going to go away. And the only thing I wanted to say was that one good strategy is just to realize that things are going to be that way at work. I mean, you're being paid to be there, and you're going to have to do things on time. And so it could help to, you know, when you get home, just find some kind of a way to shift gears. And again, this could, you know, could work in different things could work for different people. But just find a way to take a break, you know, take a nap, take a whatever it takes, and shift gears so you can just kind of realize that you shouldn't be thinking the same way at home in the evenings on the weekends that you do at work. And that's what I wanted to say, and I'll listen on the phone.
All yeah, right, no, that's thank so you. True. It's so easy to get caught in, you know, work deadline mode and carry on that way outside of the office or the factory. And, yeah, no, often the first best step is to have some kind of, you know, trick. You know, maybe it's yoga or maybe, as you say, a nap, something that shifts you down a gear so that you realize that you don't have to be dashing around as though the boss is looking over your shoulder and the clock is ticking.
I'm going to have to jump in here because I am used up my time. I'm
your
at the
clock
end.
Is ticking.
My clock is ticking. I want to thank you very much, Carl, for talking with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
Carl Honoré, the book is In Praise of Slowness, and it's published by Harper San Francisco. That's where we're going to have to leave it. Coming up next is the Afternoon Magazine. Celeste Quinn is the host for the program.
Thank you, David. Good morning. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, we'll talk with journalist Emily Yellen. And at the front during World War II. Let's take a look now at what's happening on the Chicago Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange. Prices are lower, it looks like, on the Board of Trade. July wheat, $3.51, down 9. September, $3.61, down 10. July.